Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in this session going to cover 1 Samuel chapter 21, verses 1 through 15. I will call it David at Nob in Gath. Our context is this. In our previous chapter, we see Jonathan and David conspiring to figure out whether Saul really is angry at David after Saul chased David out of Michal's apartment, his people did, chased him up to Naoth, Samuel's place of meeting for all the prophets. Finally, Saul goes up there. He is overcome by the Spirit of God and starts prophesying, laid down naked before Samuel all day, and then took off the next day, not having grabbed David, because David had gone back to Gibeah. And back at Gibeah, David meets Jonathan, and Jonathan comes up with this scheme. Hey, why don't you disappear from the new moon feast? And after 2 or 3 days, if Saul doesn't complain about you being gone, he's not angry at you anymore. It's just a temporary fit of insanity that caused him to chase you out of Michal's house. But if he gets angry, well, then we'll know you better get out of town. And they set up the scheme of shooting the arrows past the rock where David was hiding. If the arrows are to the left, it's okay to stay. When he tells the boy to go get the arrows, hey, they're to your left, or hey, the arrows are beyond you, David overhears this and he takes off. Well, that's what happened, so he takes off. And now he goes to Nob. Nob is right to the northeast of the Mount of Olives in the tribe of Benjamin. At least that's where BibleAtlas.org has it, and I'll take their word for it, although I'm sure it's Eastern's disputes where it might be, but that's close enough. So we start now in 1 Samuel 21, verse 1. Then David came to Nob to Ahimelech the priest, and Ahimelech came trembling to meet David and said to him, why are you alone and no one with you? Now at Nob there was the tabernacle. The tabernacle had been placed there by Saul. Now I'm going to give you a summary of the travels of the tabernacle once it made it to the Promised Land, relying partially or mainly on Wikipedia, but I think Wikipedia is right about this. First of all, the tabernacle was probably erected at Gilgal, where Joshua first camped when the Israelites crossed the Jordan River. That makes sense. Where else are they going to put it? They're not going to keep it packed up. So the tabernacle's at Gilgal. Then after it was at Gilgal, it was moved to Shiloh by Joshua and friends. Shiloh, which is 10 miles north of Bethel, is in the tribe of Ephraim. And it stayed there about 350 years. Now, in the midst of that 350 years, the time of the judges, the ark was stolen by the Philistines at the Battle of Shiloh, or the Battle of Ebenezer, or the Battle of Aphek, depending on what you want to call it, where the Philistines took the ark. You recall the ark gave the Philistines hemorrhoids. They sent it to Beth Shemesh, to the Israelites. The Beth Shemeshites looked into the ark. Some of them died, so they sent it to Kiriath-Jearim, and that's where the ark is right now in 1 Samuel 21, where we are. So the ark is there, but the tabernacle was still at Shiloh during all that time. Well, during the kingdom of Saul, Saul moved the tabernacle to Nob. And so that's why when David came to Nob, the tabernacle was there and Ahimelech was ministering at the tabernacle. So the ark is at Kiriath-Jearim, about 8 miles to the west of Jerusalem. Nob, the tabernacle, is right north of the Mount of Olives, which is a stone's throw from Jerusalem. But they're separate. Now, later, the tabernacle was moved to Gibeah, and that was probably done by Saul. This was after Saul massacres the priest at Nob, which we'll read about shortly. We know that in 1 Chronicles 16:39, which reads this, he left Zadok the priest and his relatives the priest before the tabernacle of the Lord in the high place, which was at Gibeon. Now, Gibeon is a small town right to the west of Jerusalem also, the northwest. And so later on, the tabernacle was moved from Gibeon to Jerusalem by Solomon, not by David, but by Solomon, David's son, as Solomon took the ark to Jerusalem in order to furnish and dedicate the temple. We read that in 1 Kings 8:4. They brought up the ark of the Lord and the tent of meeting, which is the tabernacle, and all the holy utensils which were in the tent, and the priest and the Levites brought them up. Now, that was in the time of Solomon. In the time of David, previous to Solomon, David had brought the ark, not the tabernacle now, but the ark from Kiriath-Jearim to Jerusalem, and David made a special tent for the ark, and the tabernacle stayed, the ark stayed in the tent in Jerusalem, and the tabernacle continued to reside at Gibeon to the west of Jerusalem, during David's reign. So there was a separation of the ark and the tabernacle all during David's reign. Finally, when Solomon built the temple, they all got together, and the tabernacle disappears from history after the temple was built by Solomon. Now, in the midst of all those peregrinations, or in the midst of the description of all those peregrinations, we discover that the tabernacle was always kept in the tribe of the leader of Israel. For example, when Joshua was leading Israel, his tribe was Ephraim, and Shiloh was in Ephraim, where the tabernacle was. And then when Saul was the king of Israel, his tribe was Benjamin, and Nob was in Benjamin. We know this from Nehemiah 11:32 at Anatoth. Nob, Ananiah, Anatoth was known to be in Benjamin, and Nob is mentioned right after Anatoth, and so that's talking about the exiles, giving some genealogy there, some description of the people there, and it mentions Nob as being amongst the cities of Benjamin. And besides, that's north, if it's northeast of the Mount of Olives, that's in the tribe of Benjamin. All right, so there we see that the tabernacle is in the tribe of the current leader of Israel. And when Solomon took over as king, the tabernacle was placed in the tribe of Judah because Solomon was of the tribe of Judah, and Jerusalem is in the tribe of Judah, and that's where the tabernacle ended up. So it's kind of interesting. Tabernacle goes with the leaders of Israel and their tribe. That makes sense. And anyway, that's a long excursus. Let's go back here to verse 1. David came to Nob to Ahimelech the priest. Now, who is this Ahimelech? He's the high priest, and he's either the brother of a man named Ahijah or the same person as Ahijah. We read in 1 Samuel 14:3, and Ahijah, the son of Ahitub, and then 1 Samuel 22:9, to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub. So we got Ahijah's the son of Ahitub, and Ahimelech's the son of Ahitub. Therefore, Ahijah and Ahimelech must be brothers, Ahijah having died before Ahimelech took over. That's one option. The other option is Ahijah and Ahimelech are two names for the same person, that person being the son of Ahitub. It doesn't really matter. The general supposition is, according to Ellicott, is that Ahijah and Ahimelech are the same persons. Cambridge commentary says, but it is also possible that Ahimelech was the brother of Ahijah and his successor in the high priesthood. So those are your two opinions. I'm just going to assume we're just going to call him Ahimelech and not worry about how he's related to Ahitub. Now, Ahimelech came trembling when he saw David show up. He knew that something was wrong because David appeared with no troops. And David, of course, is a military commander of 1,000 troops. And where are your troops, David? Now, Adam Clark supposes that Ahimelech probably knew nothing of the conflict between Saul and David. Now, if that's true, then that conflict would have nothing to do with Ahimelech's trembling. However, I suspect strongly that Ahimelech knew of the Saul-David conflict. After all, he's the high priest, and everybody must know what's going on. David's throwing spears at David. I mean, Saul's throwing spears at David. Of course he knew. I don't know why Clark says that. But anyway, I think he knew, and so that's why he was trembling. You come up here with no troops. Oh, you must be running from Saul, and if I put you up, Saul's going to be mad at me, as he later was. Saul carried out a lot of bloody vengeance on the house of Ahimelech. So Ahimelech had good reason to be trembling. Well, either he was afraid because he knew that Saul would be chasing David and David is looking for refuge with Ahimelech. That's one reason. But if he didn't know about the conflict between Saul and David, the fact that a great man like David is traveling alone, he normally travels with a large retinue of soldiers. He was the commander of an army unit. Where are his soldiers? Something's amiss here. We go to 1 Samuel 21:2. David said to Ahimelech the priest, "The king has commissioned me with a matter and has said to me, 'Let no one know anything about the matter on which I am sending you and with which I have commissioned you.' And I have directed the young men to a certain place," the young men being his attendants. Now, this was a bald-faced lie. He was trying to explain why he was alone. "The reason I'm alone is my soldiers have gone somewhere else. And this is a secret mission that Saul sent me on. I don't need a lot of soldiers. I can't have a lot of soldiers if the mission is going to be secret." Nice little lie. And the question that always arises, especially when you're dealing with David, was his lie justified? Well, here are two options. Yes, it was justified. David was trying to save his life. If he hadn't lied, Ahimelech, for fear of Saul, would not have helped David, and David would have died. He didn't have any food. His people didn't have any food. Plus, we'll find out in just a minute that Saul's chief shepherd, Doeg the Edomite, was there at Nob, which means that David had even more need for secrecy. If Doeg had found out, He would have told Saul, and David would have been toast. So it was justifiable for David to lie. Also, another reason why it might have been necessary for David to lie is that David may have been trying to protect Ahimelech. To protect Ahimelech from any accusation that Ahimelech had aided David in his escape. If Saul comes to find out what's going on, he says, "All right, Ahimelech, I hear that David's been here. What did you put Ahimelech up for?" And Ahimelech says, "Well, he was hungry. I just gave him some bread. Is there a problem? He just told me he was up here on a secret mission. I didn't know he was running from you and you were trying to kill him." So David might have been trying to protect Ahimelech. So that's a good argument to say that David didn't do anything wrong by lying. However, most of the commentators who get really upset when people in wartime situations lie, it just drives them crazy. Like, for example, when Jonathan and David concocted that lie to Saul in the last chapter. "Oh, the reason he's not here, Saul, at this new moon festival, is he had to go back to Bethlehem to a family feast down there." It's a total lie, but it was necessary to save David's life, and I concluded that there was nothing wrong with lying then. I'm going to conclude there's nothing wrong with him lying here, except this is a little harder case because the results of the lie were that Saul wreaked vengeance on the house of Ahimelech later on, and so the consequences were dreadful, so that if you have the advantage of hindsight, you can say, well, it was not justified because of what happened. However, I can say David didn't have the advantage of hindsight. He didn't know that Saul was going to do this to Ahimelech. But on the other hand, David felt guilty about what happened. He says in 1 Samuel 22:22, "Then David said to," it says Abiathar, that's another problem. Let's just say it's Ahimelech. "Then David said to Ahimelech, I knew on that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul, I have brought about the death of every person in your father's household." So he admitted to the death of everyone. Some people say that Psalm 119, verses 28 and 29, refers to this sad event of the murder of the priest of Nob. David says this, "My soul weeps because of grief. Strengthen me according to your word. Remove the false way from me, and graciously grant me your law." It doesn't say it refers to the slaughter of the priest at Nob. Some people say it does. James Fawcett Brown say, quote, "David probably supposed, like many other persons, that a lie is quite excusable, which is told for the sole purpose of saving the speaker's life." Well, I don't have a problem with that. I'm one of those other many persons that say, yeah, that's perfectly reasonable. Jameson Fawcett Brown continues, "But what is essentially sinful can never, from circumstances, change its immoral character. And David had to repent of this vice of lying, and he repented in Psalm 119. Verses 28 and 29. There are some other arguments that David's lie was not justifiable. The end was very small. He was just trying to get a little food, as John Gill mentions. Well, that's not a good argument. He was trying to get a little food to keep from starving. A little bit of food is a lot of food when you're starving to death, so that's ridiculous. Another reason that it's argued that David's lie was not justified is that it was a lie told to a high priest. So the high priest's status aggravated the offense. I don't buy that for a minute. A lie is a lie. It doesn't matter whether you lie to a common person or the president. Well, that's not a good example, considering I'm present president. But or to the chief of a nation, the head of a nation. It doesn't matter. Another argument is, well, the lie was told at a particularly holy place, the tabernacle of God. It's all right if you lie in the marketplace or in a restaurant, but at the tabernacle of God, I don't think that the place has anything to do with whether the lie is justified or not. Whether the lie is justified or not is, are the consequences going to be such that somebody's killed? I mean, after all, Rachel lied about the two spies that she hid, thus saving the spy's life and probably the whole lives of the Israelite nation. She lied. The Hebrew midwives lied when they told Pharaoh, we're supposed to kill these Hebrew babies, but they just keep getting born so fast, they're born before we can get there to kill them. Total lie. A lot of people like to say, but God is not a God that he should lie, according to that scripture. And I respond to that, yeah, well, God is not in danger of dying, is he? It's a little different when you're a human being down here. So I'm going to say that David didn't do anything wrong, and we're going to see in the very next chapter, he's going to carry on this charade about being insane so the Philistines don't kill him at Gath. Well, that's a lie, basically. It wasn't a verbal lie, but it was a lie by conduct. We're going to say, David, you shouldn't have done that? Well, all these people who were saying that David shouldn't have lied, I'd like to see them survive in David's place. They wouldn't have made it. They'd be dead. They wouldn't have had a chance to write their learned commentaries. Now the young men that David directs to a certain place to explain to Ahimelech why David was alone, they were probably not soldiers. They were probably sent by Jonathan to help David, John Gill speculates. They're probably just servants, attendants to help David. Because remember, he fled alone from the back window of Michael's house, of his and Michael's house from Gibeah. And then he went up to Naoth where he saw some priests. He probably didn't bring any priests with him. He's probably Jonathan sent him some people to help him. But at any rate, wherever they came from, they were the ones that probably who ate of the bread of the presence. Jesus, of course, quotes this incident in Matthew 12:13, but he, Jesus, said to them, his disciples, have you not read what David did when he became hungry, he and his companions? We go now to 1 Samuel 21:3-4. Now therefore, David continues speaking to Ahimelech, what do you, Ahimelech, have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread, or whatever can be found. 5 loaves apparently being enough to feed David's companions and himself. The priest answered David and said, there is no ordinary bread on hand, but there is consecrated bread, if only the young men have kept themselves from women. Now we need to consider what David means when he says, do you have any bread on hand? He's probably at the tabernacle. There would probably be plenty of bread in Ahimelech's house, which is at a different place. Maybe he was living in a apartment around the tabernacle, maybe, but wherever his house was, he probably had bread there, but they didn't have time to go get to wait for the bread to be brought from Ahimelech's house because Saul's chasing him. So what he means is, what kind of bread do you have right now here and there at the tabernacle? And so that's why they're going to end up talking about the bread of the presence, the holy bread, the consecrated bread that was in the holy place on the table of showbread on the northern side of the tabernacle. The priest answered David. Some people will speculate that Ahimelech used the Ummim and the Thummim before answering David. 1 Samuel 22:10 says, he, that's Ahimelech, inquired of the Lord for him, for David gave him provisions, gave him the sword of Goliath. He inquired of the Lord, and that phrase, inquired of the Lord, is often used when the priest consults the Ummim and the Thummim, which, of course, was some kind of a method consisting of some kind of objects being placed in the fold of the breastplate, where all the rocks were, where all the stones were. And in that fold was the Ummim and the Thummim, whatever it was. I always think of it as a black rock and a white rock. Should I give him food? White rock? Oh, yes, I should. Let me put my hand in there again. Should I not give him food? Draw it out. Oh, it's a black rock. No, I better not give him food. All of this guided by the Lord. This is something that still is a little strange to my mind, but it was something along that line. But again, that's speculation. But again, in the next chapter, 22:10, it says, he inquired of the Lord. Sounds like that's what he's doing. And so then Ahimelech says there's no ordinary bread. That means bread that you just eat in the household. He said, but there's consecrated bread. That's the bread that has to be made a special way. It has to be anointed with oil. It has to be placed only by a priest, not by a layman, in the holy place on the table of showbread in order for it to be Levitically legal. And so Ahimelech is in saying here, I'll give it to you. Even though it's consecrated, even though you're not supposed to have it and you're not supposed to touch it, I'll give it to you, but on one condition. The young men, your companions, have kept themselves from women. We read a couple verses, verse 6 of this chapter. So the priest gave David consecrated bread, for there was no bread there but the bread of the presence. That's why we know that the consecrated bread is the bread of the presence and not some kind of meal offering, some kind of bread offering associated with, say, a thank offering or some other kind of offering. It was the bread of the presence, the bread that's on the table of showbread, which was removed from before the Lord in order to put hot bread in its place when it's taken away. So in other words, this is consecrated bread, but it's consecrated bread that's served its weekly purpose. It was changed every Sabbath. So this would be bread that had been taken off of the altar and had not been disposed of yet, that David is wanting to eat and that Ahimelech wants to give him. Now this condition, well, first of all, this event here is quoted by Jesus, Matthew 12:4. Matthew says, how he entered the house of God, talking about David, this is Jesus talking actually, how he entered the house of God and they ate the consecrated bread, which was not lawful for him to eat nor for those with him, but for the priest alone. The reason was is because David and his companions were not priests, and that's why it was unlawful for them to eat consecrated bread. The purpose of Jesus was to attack the Pharisees' legalistic definitions of work on the Sabbath. In other words, the Pharisees were complaining that the disciples were picking grain from fields as they walked by, and they were saying, that's work, you're not supposed to work on the Sabbath. And Jesus is saying, no, it's not work. But now, Jesus used a very strong example here because David and Ahimelech didn't break a man-made law like in Jesus' time, walking along the fields and picking grain. You're not supposed to do that. That was a man-made law, a ridiculous application of the Sabbath law, a Pharisee-made law. But here, this is Moses' law. This is Levitical law. You're not supposed to touch the consecrated bread unless you're a priest. So Jesus is quoting a severe example of breaking the law in order to condemn a non-violation of the law, picking grain in the Sabbath. Now the next question is, were David and Ahimelech wrong in breaking that Mosaic law? Well, some people say yes, they were wrong. The text doesn't say they were wrong, but the text doesn't justify it either. It leaves it open, and so we have to speculate. Some people say, well, no, they weren't wrong because the law of necessity overrode Mosaic ritual law. David was about to die, and I tend to say, yeah, look, God is not going to strike somebody dead like Nadab or Abihu when somebody's about to die when they need bread. Now, verse 4 says, Ahimelech says, I give you the bread, David, as long as your men have not been with women. Actually, it doesn't say that. It says the young men have kept themselves from women. Well, first of all, what does that mean? How can women make the men unclean so they can't eat the bread? Poole says in diverse ways. Well, I don't know what he means, but I can give you an example. Perhaps touching clothes where a woman had menstruated. The law in Leviticus says you can't do that. That makes you unclean. Most probably it means having sex with their wives. You would think that, but the problem is the law doesn't say that if you have sex with your wife, you're defiled. Matthew Poole speculates that perhaps Ahimelech is reasoning by analogy from Exodus 19:15. This is when Moses is getting the people ready to confront God at Mount Sinai, and God says to the people, be ready for the third day, do not go near a woman. So the idea was sort of in the law, when you're about ready to do something holy, don't go near a woman. And maybe Ahimelech just kind of stretched it a little bit and say, well, you're getting ready to approach something holy, my consecrated bread here, so you better not go near a woman. It could be. But at any rate, he made the requirement. And I think it's strange that he would put this condition on David. I mean, after all, it was already illegal for non-priests to eat the bread. He's breaking that law. Why not break this one, too? If there's a law that says that if you eat the bread, you have to be kept from women, either from touching their menstrual rags or from having sex with your wife or whatever it means, why even bring that up? They already were breaking the law because non-priests weren't supposed to eat the bread, and David was not a priest or his people. If their non-priestly status was going to be waived for necessity, why not this, being with women? Why should that not be waived? John Gill says it might as well have been dispensed with, and I agree with him. I don't understand why. But nonetheless, Ahimelech did it. We go to 1 Samuel 21, verse 5. David answered Ahimelech, I swear that women are being kept from us, as always when I go out to battle. The young men's bodies are consecrated even on an ordinary mission. So, of course, their bodies are consecrated today. Now, this verse has got a beaucoup load of translation problems. So let's start out with, I swear that women are being kept from us, as always when I go out to battle. The King James says women have been kept with us for 3 days. The NIV says women have been kept. NIV says that women have been kept from us as usual whenever I set out. The NIV footnote says women have been kept from us in the past few days since. The NASB says women have previously been kept from us, sort of loose there. We're just going to say that the Home of Christian Study Bible makes more sense here. Whenever I go out to battle, to fight, our soldiers routinely don't have sex with their wives before they go out. That's kind of like present-day prize fighters. I say superstition. I don't know if it's superstition or not, but the practice is they don't have sex before they go into the ring because it enervates them, it weakens them, it drains them of their precious bodily fluids. I don't know why they do it. They just don't. It seems to me that if a man's about to go out to battle and he might get killed in that battle, he might like to get it on with his wife before the day of the battle because it might be his last time. But no, David, when he sends his soldiers out, no, his soldiers stay away from women. And I assume that means they don't have sex with their wives. Now, the next part of verse 5 also has translation problems. The young men's bodies are consecrated even on an ordinary mission. So, of course, their bodies are consecrated. Well, this is the way the King James translates that. Of a truth, women have been kept from us about these 3 days since I came out, and the vessels of the young men, not the bodies, as the Holman Christian Study Bible says, but the vessels of the young men are holy, and the bread is in a manner common, yea, though it were sanctified this day in the vessel. Ooh, what in the world does that mean? Well, let's take the King James. The vessels of the young men are holy. That would mean their baggage. And so their baggage, the things that they are going to hold the bread in, their utensils, not utensils, not a good word, their implements that they're going to take the bread in, they're holy. So you can put that consecrated bread in our holy implements and our baggage, our leather things, and that bread's still going to be holy, not a problem. So that's how the King James takes bodies. Instead of bodies, they call it vessels. And the bread is in a manner common, says the KJV, yea, though it were sanctified this day in the vessel. Well, that's meaningless to me. But what it is purported to mean is, although the bread had been set out that day on the showbread table and has been taken off of the showbread table, and that makes it in a manner common, makes it common bread now, it doesn't matter because it's going to be placed into consecrated vessels of my companions. In short, David says, we are holy, the bread is common, let us eat. In other words, our vessels are holy. The bread used to be holy, consecrated, but it's been taken off after the Sabbath day, after it's been there for 7 days. And when it's taken off, it's not holy anymore. It's not consecrated anymore. The consecration doesn't persist past that Sabbath week. It doesn't persist past the week that it served on the table of showbread. Now that makes sense. But is it true? The pulpit commentary says this, quote, about this translation, quote, King James translation, quote, the word bread is supplied by the translators to give some sense to this most difficult passage. Literally translated, the last two clauses are, and the way is profane, although it be sanctified today in the vessel. Among the numerous interpretations of these words, the following seems the best. And though our journey be not connected with a religious object, yet it, the bread, will be kept holy in the vessel in which it will be carried. David's argument, therefore, is that both his attendants and their wallets were free from legal defilement. And though their expedition was on some secular business, yet that at all events the bread would be secure from pollution. Well, that's pretty complicated. I guess it makes sense. But let's look at the more modern translations. The Holman Christian Study Bible has the young men's bodies are consecrated even on an ordinary mission. So, of course, their bodies, not their vessels, but their bodies are consecrated today. Well, the problem with that translation is, what makes the trip to Ahimelech at Nob more holy than an ordinary mission? David, according to this translation, is using an a fortiori argument. He's saying, look, even on an ordinary mission, we go out to fight somebody. We're consecrated. We stay away from our wives before we go out and fight. So, of course, even a fortiori, as we're coming up here to Nob to see you, of course, we are also consecrated and free from having sex with our wives. Well, the only way I can see that, and of course none of my commentators comment on this because they all use the Old Testament, the King James translation. The way I handle this is an ordinary mission would be a military mission, but of coming up to see the high priest at Nob, that's a special holier type mission, so of course we're going to be consecrated to come see the high priest. Well, now that difficult verse has been dealt with, let's go to verse 6 in 1 Samuel 21. So the priest, that's Ahimelech, gave David consecrated bread, for there was no bread there but the bread of the presence which was removed from before the Lord, in order to put hot bread in its place when it was taken away. Now some people say that the bread has just now been taken off and therefore it's on the Sabbath day. I don't know, that's reading a lot between the lines, I think. If it was on the Sabbath day, that would give even more force to Jesus' argument in Matthew 12 when he said, hey, you Pharisees, quit complaining about us, my disciples, picking grain as they go by the fields. Hey, David, not only did he eat consecrated bread and not being a priest, but he did it on the Sabbath. But that's just speculation. We don't know he did it on the Sabbath. The bread had been taken off the table of showbread, the table of the bread of the presence, been taken off. It had not been taken to Ahimelech's house yet. So it was on hand for immediate consumption by David's party. Now, here's a little problem. The bread is taken off in order to put hot bread on the Sabbath day to take its place, to renew the bread. Problem if the day that the bread was changed was the Sabbath, which it was, legally. It's illegal to bake bread on the Sabbath. So how do you put hot bread on the table of showbread if it's Saturday? Well, here's a couple of options to answer that. It wasn't illegal for priests to break on the Sabbath. Well, that's just a speculation. The scripture says, the law says nothing about that. James Fawson Brown has a better solution, I think. They say that the bread was baked just before the Sabbath and kept hot in the oven and then placed on the table, and I think that makes sense. We go down to 1 Samuel 21, verse 7. Now one of the servants of Saul was there that day, detained before the Lord, and his name was Doeg the Edomite, the chief of Saul's shepherds. Now why is Doeg the Edomite mentioned here? Well, he's mentioned to explain how Saul found out that David was there. 1 Samuel 22, the next chapter, verses 9 through 10. Then Doeg the Edomite, who was standing by the servants of Saul, said, I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob, to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub. He, that's David, inquired of the Lord for him. Ahimelech inquired of the Lord for him, gave David provisions, gave David the sword of Goliath. So that's how Saul finds out about David being at Nob, and David has to run to Gath after this incident here. How was Doeg detained at the tabernacle? How could somebody be detained at the tabernacle? Well, he could have been fulfilling a vow and had to stay there till the vow was finished. Could have been it was the Sabbath and Doeg couldn't travel, although I think that Sabbath travel restriction came from the Pharisees, who were about 1,000 years later, so I don't think that's it. Could be he was waiting for a period of purification to be over, but for some legal reason he was stuck there at the tabernacle. And he got to see all that was going on, and then he ended up going back and telling it to Saul. We go to 1 Samuel 21, verses 8 and 9. David said to Ahimelech, Now is there not a spear or sword on hand? For I brought neither my sword nor my weapons with me, because the king's matter was urgent. Then the priest said, The sword of Goliath the Philistine, whom you killed in the valley of Elah, behold, it is wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you would take it for yourself, take it, for there is no other except it here. And David said, There is none like it. Give it to me. Well, when David asked, he of course knew that the sword he had killed Goliath with, well, I say of course, John Gill says he knew that the sword he'd killed Goliath with was there, and I don't doubt that for a minute. That's sort of a big deal, a public deal. We got the sword in the tabernacle. Why didn't David have any weapons? Why is he looking for a spear or a sword? Well, he'd been on the run since he'd been let down out of his window by his wife, Michal, and when he left, it was in the middle of the night, and he was running, and he had no time to carry a weapon. Now in verse 8, David continues on with his ruse, his lie to Abimelech. The king's matter was urgent, and so I don't have any weapons. Well, it was no king's matter. He's making that up. And I don't think that Ahimelech had any reason to doubt David at this point. Now, when the priest says the sword of Goliath is here, that would of course be because the sword of Goliath was laid up as a trophy in the tabernacle, wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. The ephod is mentioned a lot. The ephod. This is my speculation. It's mentioned a lot because the Urim and Thummim were kept on the breastplate, which was on the ephod, and so it was kind of a symbol of the priesthood. I don't know. And in verse 9, Ahimelech says, There's no other weapon here except the sword of Goliath. And of course, there's no other weapon there. Priests normally don't carry swords. So David was lucky that there was a sword in the tabernacle. We go down to verse 10, 1 Samuel 21. Then David arose and fled that day from Saul and went to Achish, king of Gath, that very day while the rush, because Doeg the Edomite was there. And David, I'm sure, saw him, and he would say, Oh, Doeg's going to go back to Gibeah and tell Saul that I'm here, and so he's got to get out of Dodge. Gath is Goliath's hometown. Now that was a brilliant place for David to flee to. Who would ever think of looking for David in Goliath's hometown, in the midst of David's Philistine enemies? Other surrounding lands were at peace with Israel. If David had flown there to any other land, and Saul had asked the king of those lands to give David up, they would have said, We don't want a war with Saul. Here's David. We don't want him. So it was pretty smart for him to go there. Now, it was dangerous to flee there, as we'll see. But it was also just as dangerous to stay in Israel, so David might as well risk his life in order to save it. And so he did. He went to Gath. This shows how seriously that David took Saul's enmity, because he was willing to withstand the danger there in Philistia, figuring that was less dangerous than staying in Gibeah with Saul. Now, David might have thought he could get away with this plan by fleeing to Philistia, because the Philistines might want to use David against Saul, their enemy. David's opposed to Saul. The Philistines are opposed to Saul. Maybe we can come to a common understanding. Now, where is Gath in relation to Nob? If you look at the map, BibleAtlas.org, it's about 25 miles southwest of Nob, right there in the Shephelah, in the lowlands, the area of Philistia, the very head of the Valley of Elah, at the eastern end of which is Socah, where David killed Goliath, and Gath is at the western end where Goliath was born. We go down to 1 Samuel 21, verses 11 through 15. But the servants of Achish said to him, "Is this not David, the king of the land? Did they not sing of this one as they danced, saying, 'Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s?'" Of course, they're referring to Philistines that they were singing about. "David took these words to heart and greatly feared Achish, king of Gath. So he disguised his sanity before them and acted insanely in their hands and scribbled on the doors of the gate and let his saliva run down into his beard. Then Achish said to his servants, 'Behold, you see the man behaving as a madman. Why do you bring him to me? Do I lack madmen that you have brought this one to act the madman in my presence? Shall this one come into my house?'" Now, apparently, before this scene, Achish had received David with respect, perhaps wanting to use him against Saul, and so he wants to hear him out. But then the servants of Achish, the courtiers, apparently started thinking about this and said, "No, wait a minute now. David's the king of the land. That means the king of Israel. It could be the king of the land of the Philistines because he had beaten Goliath, but I don't think so. I think what it means, king of Israel, because the Philistines had perhaps heard that Samuel had anointed him as king, because David had constantly led victorious armies of Israel against the Philistines, because the courtiers heard that the women were comparing David's slain 10,000s to Saul's slain 1,000s, Philistines. So they were scared of this guy. And here you are trying to cozy up to him, thinking you're going to use him against Saul. And so when David started feeling the heat, thinking that Achish was going to turn on him, he pretends he's insane. Now, John Gill says that he didn't pretend that he was insane, but that he was actually insane. Gill quotes the Septuagint, "Behold, you see an epileptic man. Why have you introduced him to me?" Epileptic. Well, that's not really insane. Gill saying that David really had epilepsy and started acting nuts. No, I don't think so. Now, I've got a question for all of you who think that David was wrong in lying to Ahimelech at Nob. Oh, God is not a God that he should lie. David should not have lied. Was David also to be condemned for this play acting here? The acting was an equivalent of a lie. Here's what Adam Clark says. "I dare not be the apologist of insincerity or lying. I confess I can neither feel the force nor the morality of this. Deceit and hypocrisy can never be pleasing in the sight of God." Really? What about the Hebrew midwives? What about Rachel? Well, that's an old story. I won't get into that. I would just like to say, if Mr. Clark was here, I'd say, "Mr. Clark, what would you have done in David's situation?" You know, all these people saying, "I'd never lie, never lie. It's immoral to lie." What would you have done? If David hadn't lied, he'd have been dead before we even got to Gath and King Achish. So David pretends he's insane. He's got spittle running into his beard in verse 13. Saliva. Now, spitting on beard is considered an intolerable indignity in the Eastern culture, whether done by yourself or somebody else. So that was pretty nasty to those people back then. And Achish said, "Why don't you bring this madman to me?" Now, here's an option to consider here. Maybe Achish didn't really believe he was a madman. Maybe he was trying to take the heat off of David so Achish could actually use David against Saul. And maybe he's just pretending in front of his courtiers that he thinks that David is mad. I don't think so. I think that Achish really did believe that David was crazy. He might have thought that the strain of dealing with Saul had pushed David over the edge, and that since David was crazy, that would explain why David was foolish enough to run right into the Philistine city of Gath. Now, the servants brought David in his allegedly insane state. They brought him, the servants did, brought him to Achish because they expected Achish to arrest David. But Achish looked at David acting crazy. He said, "What's the point of arresting this guy?" That's why he said, "Look, I got madmen enough. I don't need another one." He's probably referring to the fools, you know, court fools that bring some entertainment to courts. At least they did in the Middle Ages. Maybe they did so in the time of Philistia. I don't know. He says, "Do I lack madmen?" In other words, I've already got them around here. I don't need another one. I don't know who he's referring to, the madmen he's already got. I'm assuming they're people who act crazy for fun, court fools. At any rate, we're going to leave David here pretending like he's insane as we'll get ready to go to chapter 16, our next chapter, chapter 22. Our next chapter, verses 1 through 23, we'll see David fleeing from Gath and going to the cave of Adullam, there to the west of Jerusalem in the Philistine plain. We'll see you next time, I hope you enjoyed this audio.